From iAfrican Media, this is iAfrican Bites, a podcast that features commentary on African news, insights, opinions, and analysis with tech industry leaders and professionals. The podcasts are from interviews conducted by the iAfrican team, whether at events or when needed for commentary. I'm Badawun Kosokwane, host and editor-in-chief for iAfrican.com, spelled www.iafrican.com.
And we're at the University of Ghana with Dr. Shakir Mohammed, one of the original co-founders and trustee. It's been, what, 7 years now?
Yes.
I call the Board of Trustees like the AI Avengers. What's your version of how did you guys come together? Was it through text, WhatsApp? Like, describe it for me.
There are many kind of origin stories, and Actually all organizations retell their origin stories many times. But the origin story we tell was we were at a very large, the largest conference of our field of AI in Barcelona, sir, in 2016.
Yes, sir.
And in December 2016, we got there. I'm a South African. My Ulrich, one of the co-founders, is also South African. So we got there, and this one day, it was an amazing day in Barcelona. The sun is shining. Yes. The beach is looking gorgeous. Yes. And we looked around. It was like, where are the other South Africans? We were just asking that question. It's like, how come we only ever see each other? And then, like, as this day went by, we're like, okay, wait. The people from Lesotho are not here.
Yes.
The people from Swaziland, or in that time it was called Swaziland.
Yes.
The people from Zimbabwe.
Yes.
A whole continent seems to be not there. Now, we were not the only ones recognizing this kind of absence.
Okay.
So then what we actually did, because I was very close to the organizers, I could write an email. I said, can you send me some of the data from the last 10 years of who was at this conference? And
Africa.
Then eventually we looked at all the data from their global submissions to this conference. The conference is called Neural Information Processing Systems. I'm lucky today actually to also become a board member of that organization to help reshape it and give my part.
Yes.
But we eventually wrote a blog post, and the title of this blog post was called The Missing Continents. Because what we saw in that data for the last 10 years prior, so that was 2016, so from 2006 to 2016, there were zero papers from Africa, from people based in Africa submitting to that conference. And the same thing was true for South America, that they had maybe one or two.
So it was also from America and then Europe.
Western
Europe,
and you know, the rest, and you know, the China was growing, there's a lot of Chinese.
Yes.
But still, this is the kind of a field that was slowly getting bigger and bigger.
Yes.
It has aspirations to be international.
Yes.
That's the kind of conference we were at. That this technology is going to be globally transformative, bringing new age of prosperity.
Yes.
But whose prosperity?
Yes.
Our people were not there.
Yes.
I could not find another South African. Never mind the whole continent. So yeah, where were we? So then, you know, we came the next year. We were thinking it over in January 2017. Then I wrote to Ulrich. I said, well, I think what we should do is just the two of us should go and do something. And then slowly this idea was like, okay, let me see if we can get some money.
Okay.
So I wrote to the CEO of DeepMind. And I said, I want to do this idea. What I need from you is to give me the small amount of money,
it
was £15,000, and the time to go, and just a few days.
Organize it just
and then sort of as we did that, I was like, well, if we're going to go, why don't we invite some other people to come? Instead of just the students of Wits University, the University of the Witwatersrand, that we were going to go to and use as a host, like, why don't we ask more people to join us?
Yes.
And why don't we not only do South Africa, but think of a whole continent.
Yes.
And then eventually, by the time we reached September of 2017, we had 300 people. They came from 26 African countries.
Wow.
We had an entire week. And so began the first deep learning in Durban. And now, 7 years later, we are in the amazing city of Accra in Ghana.
Yes.
And we have done a kind of commitment that we had, that we would take this organization that was going to be created to belong to everyone.
Yes.
We would move it to this entire continent. And I think we've done that now. We've been in South Africa,
100%.
In Nairobi, in Eastern East Africa, in North Africa, in Tunis, in Tunisia, now in West Africa, in Accra. And so the question that I'm asking everyone this week, it's a good question to be able to ask, is what happens when dreams come true?
Yeah. Oh, that's a nice title.
Because you don't think...
That should be
you
a
don't think.
Exactly.
You don't think your dreams are actually going to come true. Because you think they're far away, they are unattainable, they're really difficult. But I think this is sort of the power of this community and this Indaba, that dreams come true when you do them together. The core value of the Indaba is Mata Kane, that idea of we build together. Yes. Right, and so, anyway.
Okay, Doc Shikir, I'm going to do something different. I'm looking at your impressive LinkedIn.
Which is not up to date, so
not up to
date. I should go and update it.
You need to update it, definitely. But I'm gonna just, you know, mention one or two things, and then you tell me, walk me through the journey, what was happening.
Okay.
And what were you primarily doing in those different roles? So you're a business analyst around 2006 at NetBank. What were you doing?
So I had finished a master's degree that year. I was in electrical engineering. I was at the University of the Witwatersrand. And then, of course, your degree ends. You need to move on. You need to go and do a job.
Yes.
But I had been working with my mentor. He's actually a very renowned South African. His name is Chilidzi Marwala. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, in the sort of half year before, it's like, here, I think you should go and apply to do a PhD overseas.
Wow.
And he said specifically, you should go to Cambridge and go and do this PhD.
Okay.
And so for many weeks, he would come to my desk.
Ask you about that.
How is the application to Cambridge? And then I would say, oh, I'm going to work on it. Because, of course, deep down, I am from this small town in the south of Johannesburg. We are on the other side of the
100%.
World. We don't go to the most ancient university where Darwin 100%. And Newton and these people. So anyway, we'd come every week. He came maybe for 6 weeks. So she came. How is the application to Cambridge coming?
Wow.
And so eventually I sent it, and I also sent an application to the Commonwealth Scholarship.
Yes.
And then I received it, and then... But of course, you know, in South Africa, our year is the calendar year. We start in January, we end in December.
Yes.
But in the Northern Hemisphere, their academic years start in October and end in September.
Yes.
So there was this 6 months. I didn't know if I was going to be accepted. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go find a job, work. And then if this thing comes, then, you know... Of course, I had to keep that secret from these people who are employing me, and you know, but I had a great time there, and also it was a great experience just to see a little bit of what kind of corporate culture looks like, at least in the banking industry, 100%. And sort of the early versions of simple statistical models that are still underlying the way banking and financial industries work today. So.
I mean, Prof. Marwala is now the VC of
UN University.
Yes. I mean, what's the relationship with you? I mean, between you guys now?
We keep in touch all the time. I was just in Tokyo, actually, two months ago.
Okay, and at his campus.
Visited the United Nations University.
Yes.
I sat in a panel.
Yes.
We had a wonderful discussion about the role of AI.
Beautiful.
And and that's a, you know, you never lose. It's the great thing about your mentors, and that's sort of also what the Indaba is for, is to create that opportunity for people to find mentors 100%. And champions and advocates. And once you find them, they are with you for your entire life in some way,
100%.
And you add to each other in different kinds of ways. So.
Let's lobby him to be here next year.
Yeah, I think next year he should come wherever we end up on this beautiful continent of ours.
Now, you started at DeepMind 2014.
Yeah.
How did you land? Is it 2006, 2014?
It should be 13.
Should be 13, okay. Walk me through the journey. How did you get to DeepMind?
Like all things, it's very random. It's just knowing someone.
Okay.
So I was doing a fellowship, a postdoctoral fellowship in Canada.
Oh, Canada.
In the time, and the fellowship was ending.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to end in March 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that summer before, so it was July, I had met someone who was on the same fellowship also in Canada.
Yes, sir.
And so we had spoken. I was like, okay, it's lunchtime. Mm. So what are we going to do?
What are we going to do?
The money is running out. We need to figure out. So we were both in the same situation. And what this person said to me, he had been previously in Switzerland.
Yes.
And I was like, well, I just had a conversation with... This person, he's one of the co-founders of this new organization called DeepMind.
Yes.
They are starting up in London.
Yes.
I think you should go and have a chat with them. So I wrote an email. I actually did a small round of very informal interviews. And I think there was a kind of uncertainty of their funding streams. And actually, they weren't sure if I was going to be the right kind of person.
Yes.
And so initially, nothing was going to come out of this. It just moved on. But then later on in November that year, November 2012, I got an email back. It's like, okay, you should come now and join. I said, okay, I'm going to come. I'm going to wait for my fellowship to end, wrap up things, and then move over to London.
Yes.
And then the rest is history. And I've been there since I had my 10-year anniversary earlier this year. And it's been great to look back at a decade of myself growing, myself helping an organization grow, an organization helping me grow, and having done a wonderful set of work, I think, over that time.
You know, Dr. Shakir, I see your story in deep learning, Darwin, how now deep learning in Daba is, you know, facilitating research opportunities for students, peer reviews for, you know, those writing abstracts. So as you're telling me your story, I see, oh, this is why they have this program. This is why we have the sessions. This is why, I mean, right, we just came from the InstaDeep hackathon and they're giving, you know, $1,500 to the winners. Now, one of the participants in the hackathons said that's about 1.2 million naira. So that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
So as you speak, I see how what you went through, you tried to solve those with deep learning in Daba.
Yeah.
Prof, what was the happiest moment for you through the years with deep learning in Daba as this baby's growing? What's been the one or two happiest moments where you're like, okay, I understand what was the bigger calling in starting deep learning in Daba?
You know, conveniently, I get that feeling every year.
Okay.
Every September, when we come, you know, I often say, I think most people in this world won't get to the point where they completely and fully understand that they, for in a small way, change the world. Mm. But when we come for this week, and after the first few days where everything is late, everything is broken, the internet doesn't work, there may not be water, some doors are locked, the first year, a sprinkler went off, started to... So after all of that goes by, then you just look, and then you understand actually what the power of connection, what the power of opportunity looks like, what the power of just helping people see a level just a little bit above them.
Yes.
It's not out of reach. They can easily be it. And then you see that, yes, okay, you have made your footnote in the history of this world and the change. And that is a standout moment because you can go through many things in your professional life, in your daily life of struggle, things that are angering you, things that are irritating, your political situation in our countries, many, many things, but you can come and you can always reflect back on that. And actually the standout memory that I always have is, if I come back, we always take a picture together every year as the organizers.
Yes.
And I always go back to just look, and I can remember the feeling of standing together.
Yes.
It's usually on the steps of some university in Stellenbosch, in Kenyatta University, in SUPCOM, here in University of Ghana. And I can always remember that feeling of how powerful it is that a small group of people can come together and you can literally change the world in some way. Because Indaba has, in some sense, been that kind of power, such a powerful model that has been picked up across the world by many other organizations. Yes. So in South America, that I told you that story initially, they created an organization that looks very much like the Indaba to solve the same problem for their communities.
Yes.
In Eastern Europe, they have the same issue, created a community to deal with that. In Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Malaysia, they created the same kind of community structure because that's such a reproducible, proven structure, creates leadership, creates opportunity, creates joy, I think.
Yes, 100%. I like how you light up when you talk about this. And it reminds me of like, why I fell in love with technology in the first place. So I'm in cybersecurity, and as I'm looking at you, I'm like, okay, I'm falling in love with what I'm doing. You know, so.
It's good. We need to be reminded 100%. About why it is we came to our field
it's very
and
extremely
see
important.
It again with fresh eyes.
Yes. Doctor, you've got a really impressive academic output in terms of citations. In your experience, what is the landscape, you know, right now? What are the trends in terms of machine learning on the continent? What are we doing good? What could we improve on?
It's such a complicated, multifaceted question. So we can start with the goods and the bad. So one of the things that we do very well is we recognize that there is a kind of non-traditional learning path that people take. It's actually one of the most common things that you'll find. People usually would not go to undergrad, go to master's, do a PhD, end up in this postdoc, apply for these faculty conditions. They won't look in that kind of straight way. So people are very creative, very optimistic, very in control of sort of their learning path by just seeking opportunities, latching onto them, going forward with it. And I think that gives a very powerful strength, and you can see it this week at this in deep learning in Daba, but you see it throughout the year at all of these satellite events. So one of the advantages is then how do we lean into that kind of structure, that kind of way of learning, that kind of way of creating also, and also to make that legible in some way to others. So people who only see and can only understand the world through that kind of structure approach, when they are confronted with people who don't go through that, it becomes very difficult. And you see the barriers that those people then face. They don't interview well. 100%. They don't write CVs well. They don't sell themselves in some way, or, you know, do that kind of thing that we need to create around why it is you should hire me, or why you should give me, take a risk on me. So I think there's that sort of one challenge, but structurally, we do need to make several kinds of changes. We need to be able to do more cooperation as countries 100%. Together, because it is only in this kind of phase where AI is becoming such a geopolitical question,
yes,
where it is so talked about by every government,
everybody.
Where everyone
heads
wants a piece of the action, every
yes.
head of state. When you are a smaller country, your electricity is unstable, your education system of higher education is not mature, or it goes through ups and downs and phases, then we have to cooperate as countries to be able to bring the kind of money together that's needed, bring the kind of computing infrastructure that's needed, bring the kind of intellectual resource and capacity that's needed. So I think much more of that. And, you know, probably the simplest thing we could do is to redo the visa situation
yes.
that's happening
yes.
for countries across the continent. It's complicated to bring people to Ghana.
Yes.
It's complicated to bring people to South Africa. It's complicated everywhere in a way that should not be complicated. And how do you do cooperation if the most basic entry mechanism of a country is so difficult and so expensive that most people will not do it and will not be an option to do it? So.
100%. I need to understand, at what point personally did you fall in love with the machine learning? At what point were you from, because you know, you're electrical engineer circuits, I mean, part yeah. of my ignorance, but at what point you're like, okay, I want to do this with that?
You know, I think one of the great things of at least our South African universities
yes.
was that they were actually very well structured to have foresight of the changing nature of fields
yes.
at a kind of very broad level. And so when I entered, you know, university, the university had already seen that there is a kind of emergence of information as a kind of concept that's going to redesign. So an engineering program came that was both about electrical and information engineering.
100%.
And was designed in some way. So already you could start, everyone does the same thing, but I already could have a sense like, okay, this information route, software engineering, software practices, building and architecting systems,
yes.
thinking about data, simple statistical methods,
yes.
all of these simple cryptographic methods,
yes.
security methods. All of those were much more interesting because they seemed to open many other
okay.
ways. And I did many of my projects on computational biology,
yes.
and that already made clear, like, oh, there's this data, but you also have an analytical skill,
yes.
and there's a kind of need and prediction problem and task. So,
yes.
So slowly I made more and more changes. I was doing work on vibrations of electrical machines, then working on DNA structures and protein prediction, and then wanting to be able to do more in that field to become, to see, well, what could it be like to become at the state of the art, to not just see a toolkit
yes.
and just learn to apply the toolkit.
Yes.
What would it make to add to this toolkit or do something completely different or the thing that you were like so afraid of?
Yes.
Or like, this thing seems like hell of a complicated.
Yes.
To actually confront it, dig deep. And so
yeah.
so that was sort of the journey. And then, you know, I went and I just now, over the course of my career, just continually, I think there's just a leaned into that curiosity.
Yes.
So I actually have changed my field almost
okay.
every few years. So I used to do lots of work in biology,
yes.
but my PhD thesis was in a very statistical topic
okay.
of Bayesian statistics. When I immediately joined DeepMind, I was working in the early phase of generative models.
Mm.
And probably one of the things I'm most recognized for is our early work in generative models and making them a kind of core concept in a bigger
yes.
part of our field. But then I always was like, well, you can do a lot of amazing theoretical work,
yes.
but theoretical work that doesn't actually touch the world in some way seems kind of missing.
Yes.
So then I switched my
field. It's not as impactful as
you would
like it to be.
Not as impactful. And you always ask, like, well, where are these generative models actually
useful
for?
Yeah.
So I've worked in healthcare. We did some amazing work on doing organ damage predictions
okay.
with large
amazing.
Electronic health records. And I switched then later to start working in environmental science, which is where I still work today around climate, weather, and that role of environment. And then I keep changing my field again because there's no point doing amazing technical work in the field like environment and climate if somehow that combination of things doesn't actually give benefit to the people it's meant to give benefit to. So now we have a different kind of thinking around socio-technical AI, this idea that society and technology are actually one thing, together. You must think of them together and you must account for those. You don't just can't just pretend. I said, this is going to benefit you all. You have to prove it in some way because there are more examples of injustice and dispossession and marginalization than there are examples of actual benefits. We have to remember. So I've done a lot of work in that space, and this is where I am. And 100%. Anyway, I don't know where your initial question started.
Don't worry, you're spot on somewhere. Dog, we're in our seventh year now as the Deep Learning Indaba. You're very big on community. You have an impressive list of sponsors. Why do your sponsors keep coming back every year? What's the value? When you sit in those boardrooms with them, when you review your monitoring and evaluation, what are the key metrics do they appreciate that Deep Learning Indaba takes off for them?
I think there are, again, many layers of that. One answer is, well, why does any organization or come or want to be involved with other organizations? And I think that's because most organizations who have a sense of maturity about themselves will realize that they can't do everything
themselves.
They can't see everything.
Yes.
And to claim to see and do everything will be a kind of hubris that would sort of, you know, doesn't make good business sense even in that sense. So I think knowing that there is a limitation to what organizations themselves can see, can know, can do, sort of means that they want to go into spaces that help them see differently, help them see better, plan for the long run of questions. And I think that initial thought then connects, of course, many businesses, and of course, the main beneficiaries of the Indaba are the attendees themselves. Yes. So for us, it's better to focus on the attendees. Yes. The attendees are here to learn, to gain education of AI, deep learning, to meet a network.
Yes.
But that education needs to give them a benefit through a career path.
Yes.
And so by bringing those connections again between industry, between other academics, between other kind of civil society partners and this kind of beneficiary group, that's sort of where magic can happen on moving, bringing talent to sort of where there is a demand for talent. And also having people see that actually you may not be showing up in the right kind of way and this is a good way for you to learn about it. And of course then going back to something I said earlier, there is a sense that we use the word that AI is international or that it's global or that it is universal or all these big kinds of words, but that needs to have some mass or truth to it in some way. And so that means you need to go and connect with those communities who are marginalized according to the West or underrepresented or underinvested in some way. And so I think for all of these reasons, a mixture of them, there's never one reason why. Of course, any organization depends on amazing champions in those organizations who have a vision themselves to show that actually if you work with these communities, they will surface problems that actually will be useful to us later on in the same way, and then we can give some things back.
100%.
And so, I think there's a kind of multifaceted complexity in which versions people pick and choose.
Yes.
But again, our mission of strengthening African machine learning now means, in some sense, to create that platform where everyone comes, and then on that platform, what happens is sort of where the magic of everything is.
Yes.
And so the platform is the important bit now.
Yes. Doc, you remember, and a trustee of the board of executives, one of the co-founders, strategically, in those Zoom meetings as, you know, the executive and trustees and in your important positions, what strategic objective going into your 10th year anniversary, what strategic objective is priority right now in those meetings? What are you looking at to be like, okay, cool, by the time we're 10 years, this needs to happen or we need to mark this milestone or whatever?
Yeah. I'll just make a comment. You know, many people think, like, you know, that title, chair of the board of trustees sounds important, but actually, this is the very hard work. Yeah. It's the most boring work of dealing with finances, doing accounting, making annual reports, dealing with legal questions, the grunt work.
Yes.
And there's all this kind of household work.
Yes.
Communities only function because household work is essential. Any organization only functions because there are people who do household work.
Prof, what's he said? Now you're an AI politician.
We are AI politicians, which is another... Yeah, you have to do all these other kinds of... Which is not necessarily glamorous or sexy, but it is the vital work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
So, you know, that strategic... But that also gives us the power, the opportunity, and the responsibility to be strategic in some way.
Yes.
So... I guess, you know, the first question of strategicness for the existence of this organization is to place it in a sustainable framework for itself.
100%.
That my time as a trustee will end. A new set of trustees will come and take over.
Yes.
That sustainable path of ownership, again, back to the community, mm-hmm. that this is not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't own this.
Mm-hmm.
It actually belongs to everyone. So that ownership needs to go. We need to create the structure, mm-hmm. both financially, organizationally. I think that's important. Again, that's part of the household work that needs to be done. But the kind of grander vision then, again, is to think about where is it that AI research won't just be conducted, that we don't just teach people, but then now we start connecting that to actual real impact in the world. And impact can be many different kinds of things. So I hope we're going to see more of that, more grand challenges, more recognition of the amazing leaders we have on our continent, a greater standard of research papers than we've ever seen in the last 7 years or even 10 years before at that point. And a more kind of vibrant community that will expand in touch in many more ways. And I guess the key idea is that the deep learning in Durban won't be right now. Its key idea or key association is as an annual big event. Although we have, over the time of our 7 years, helped establish leadership and new communities in 36, 37 distinct African countries, and that's where significant more in investment needs to go, that those countries themselves become so big, because that's what we need to do. You can never scale this event to 10,000 people. Mm. If you go to their countries and each event themselves, that's 300,000 people.
The WXs, the small WXs across the continent.
So if they grow, we can invest in them in different ways.
Yes.
So I really want to see that, because that's where the work of impact, the seed of the work of impact begins. Because you see this week, people who are working on waste management in their local city, people are working on tomato plant diseases, people who are working on local languages and preserving their culture. This work can only happen localized, in a specific. If I live in Namibia, I care about Namibian culture. No one else is going to care about that. And so that has to happen, and you need to have that strength and capacity.
Yes.
So over time, I think that's sort of where we will go. I do have a document written, which is called At the Indaba's 10th Anniversary.
Oh, so the document is there already.
It's empty right now.
It's
an open space
for us to
imagine together, to dream together, to be Afro-futuristic, globally futuristic, to be a bit dystopian if we want
that.
To be, and then confront the reality of where we actually want to take things. But I think I'm extremely optimistic about where we are going. There are many, many challenges ahead around global cooperation, around geopolitics, around... you know, the increasing disparity and concentration of power in some places rather than others. But again, the singular way you can always address that is through building a bigger voice together.
Yes.
So that's maybe the general. But anyway, I reserve the right to change my mind on any of this.
Dr. in Accra, lastly, how's the Ghanaian jollof?
I have been loving it. I love coming. I've come to been to Accra once before. I had such a good time. So I've been waiting ever since my last time was 2019.
Okay.
The jollof is great.
What's the fish?
The tilapia and the banku.
Okay.
The beach is amazing.
The beach is amazing.
And actually, this is a country steeped in so much history of colonialism, injustice. But it also is a country that gave us greatness, 100%. One of the greatest leaders of our continent, Kwame Nkrumah. And actually, this year's Indaba began with a quote from Kwame Nkrumah. It was the initial theme. He wrote in one of his speeches, I think, at the All Africa Conference, We do not look east or west. We look forward.
100%.
And that was sort of how 100%. We began this year's Idaba. And, you know,
Prof, here we are. Thank you so much, Doctor. Oh, my goodness. Dr. Shakir Mohammed, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to speak. Yes.
Where are we going next year?
So there's a lot of
options. There's a lot of options.
A lot of things to think through. Okay. Again, that choice is about who has energy, who is the right time to do this.
Yes.
This year is an amazing year to come to Ghana to do this event. It's Ghana's year to step up in AI, to strengthen their AI strategy, their data protection, the role of their government's leadership.
Yes.
So the role of their industries, both multinationals and locals, their startup. So, you know, again, that kind of thinking of like where we want to be is to sort of put a pinpoint, direct everyone's attention. You should be thinking about this country because this is sort of where you're going to make money, you're going to build joyful products, you're going to create prosperity in some way. So,
Doc, thank you so much for your vision and foresight. We're going back to the sessions. I think there's an instant deep one.
There's a JP Morgan hackathon
happening.
There's the amazing poster sessions.
There's the poster sessions happening. And amazing stuff during the rest of the week.
So it's a jam-packed afternoon and the rest of the week for us. Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to iAfrican Bites. Please share your feedback with us on our socials. On Twitter at iAfrican. On LinkedIn at iAfrican.com. And check out our other podcasts, The Tefo Mohapi Show, Take Legal Matters, and The Lead Creator, on all podcast streaming platforms. And also make sure to head over to www.iafrican.com. That is iafrican.com/radio. And subscribe for notifications. iAfrican Bites is an iAfrican Media original show. Produced by Nzalo Mbangana and content producer and host by Don Kotokwane.